And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Leroy N. from the Heavy Hitters Group. He's got a remarkable story. I had the privilege of hearing it at the Atlanta Men's Workshop recently. And he kept 400 men spellbound and made a big impact on my life and many others. And I'm sure he'll share that with you again tonight. Please welcome Leroy M.
My name's Leroy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the God of my understanding, which today I choose to call Jesus Christ, for giving me a chance to have a chance. It's only because of him and you people that I haven't found it necessary to drink. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. A few quick housekeeping rules. When I say what my higher power is, that's just the higher power of my understanding, the God of my understanding. Doesn't have to be yours. You can choose whatever you want. But today, it wasn't always like that, as you will hear in my story. But today I'm able to say that with conviction. That's what my higher power is today. And I just have to honor him, at least when I'm at the podium. From this point forward, I'll just refer to him as God. I won't say God of your understanding. I won't say higher power. If you're new, you need to read the first 164 pages of the big book and all the appendices and everything prior to page one. And I promise you, you'll get a better understanding of what that's about. I am a proud member of the Heavy Hitters Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet Saturdays at 5 o'clock. My sobriety date is September 27th, 1993. To go into basically how it was, basically born in New York, and probably my first drink, I don't remember a whole lot about it, but I was probably about 6 or 7 years old. And what it was is that I used to watch cartoons every Saturday morning, and my mother and father had a party, and they didn't want to clean up after the party. And when I woke up the next morning, I saw some glasses half empty, half full, and I commenced to drink them. And I woke up in the hospital and had a case of alcohol poisoning. But then later on, you know, one of the things that where my alcoholism began prior to me ever picking up a drink was the fact that I wanted to hang around older kids. For whatever reason, I did not want to hang around kids that were my age. I don't know if that was because I was an only child at that time and I didn't have a big brother or any of that, but that was the deal. I hung around the older kids, and to hang around the older kids, I had to make sure I was prepared to do whatever I was big and bad enough to do. I had to be able to take dares and do things that none of them would do just in order to fit in. So I'd already had that ism. You know, a sense of belonging or that self-esteem issues of wanting to belong. So that's what I did. Eventually got to a point probably at around 11, we did one of those deals, stopped someone older to go buy alcohol for us, and that's how I started my first drink. In my story, there are some other uses that I have other than the alcoholism. I will do my very, very best to respect the singleness of purpose. And, you know, one of the things I had to learn coming into this program was, you know, every group is autonomous, and you do have certain things that each group follows. Some are more lenient than others. But, you know, it's a real simple deal. You know, even if I do have other experiences other than alcohol, I can just say use, or even if I use drink, in my mind, it means everything, you know, because I wasn't able to ever do one without the other. But as I move forward, later on, we moved back to Carolina. One of the things that were significant was my relationship with my dad. My dad was a very hardworking man. When we were in New York, he worked like two jobs, you know, 18-wheeler truck driver for the post office, and he drove a Trailways or Greyhound bus. So he wasn't around a lot. And during the times when he was around, it was either us watching TV together, and there wasn't a whole lot said. And there were some times when, you know, he has some extracurricular activities with other women, and I got taken along in the process. And that had an impact on me, and I'll mention that later on. In any event, me and my mother ended up moving back to North Carolina where they were from. And by that time, my sister had arrived, so I had a little sister. And one of the other things, while I was in New York going through elementary school, I also was having an issue with not having any self-control. Another trait before I had to drink. I was also always vying for attention. Another trait that had to do with my alcoholism long before the drink. So those things had already started. I got suspended every year in school. I either got suspended or kicked out every year, all the way up until the 12th grade. So anyway, we moved to North Carolina. And as soon as we get to North Carolina, again, I got to hang with some older cats. So I immediately hook up with one of my mother's best friend's son, and he's several years older than me, and he was the person that was going to teach me how to take my drinking and using to a next level. He was going to teach me about women, you know. I made his sister teach me to smoke. All these things, I just felt it needed to be done. I, you know, by the time I got down there, I go in the bathroom. They were smoking cigarettes in the bathroom, and I couldn't smoke. And they was like, "You need to get out of here." So I was like, "I got to learn how to smoke. I got to get in there." And so that's what I did. I mean, I made her give me a one night crash course on smoking, and that's what we did till I got it right. You know, things progressed. You know. My deal started up, I'm still underage, so a lot of times, and then the person I'm hanging with, he's underage, so to drink, we really didn't have no money, so I had to steal it. So I became very good at going into the convenience stores and stealing the wine. You know, we'd steal the Richards, Wild Irish Rose, and the Mad Dog 2020, all that kind of stuff. You know, and that was part of the drinking deal, you know. And that went all the way on through high school. There were times when we'd just, you know, get a bottle to drink going to school, get a bottle to drink leaving from school. So that continued to progress. Later on, I experimented with some other things. But what I can tell you is no matter what other things that I experienced, I either had to drink before I started with them, or I had to drink when it was over. You know, it always started out with drinking, and it always ended with drinking. Now, there might have been some things that happened in between, but that's how it always went. Eventually, what ended up happening to me is that I ended up going into the military, and I chose the Navy. And the Navy is the greatest enabler for drinking that you ever want to try. And it was accepted. It was like they did everything possible to make sure you could drink as much as you want for as cheap as you wanted. And that's what I did. Then I went out on an aircraft carrier. That took it to another level, you know. So I did a lot of things. I was on a big aircraft carrier with 5,000 other men. It was like a city. And the drinking and using was accepted. And that's what I did. Over time, that began to catch up with me and get me in a little trouble. I was getting in trouble with MPs, you know, getting drunk, fighting the sentries in front of the barracks, you know, just getting caught doing all kinds of stuff. And it was only by the grace of God that I didn't get kicked out. You know, he had somebody looking over me because, you know, they kind of would tell me ahead of time, look, it's about to get bad for you. So, look, if you leave now, we can offer you this, you know, general under honorable conditions, and you at least get your benefits out the deal. And I had to take that deal because with the behavior that I had going and the route that my alcoholism was starting to take, I wasn't going to, you know, do right. It was clear in my mind. So I took that out. Came back out as a civilian, and I ended up coming back to New York to live with my dad. And when I came back to New York to live with my dad, you know, we were still somewhat distant because I had this huge resentment that, you know, how could you dare cheat on my mom when she is the nicest woman in the world? How could you do this, you know? So that was always between us. And he owed me, so that's the attitude that I went up there with. And Then I ended up, you know, meeting some people, and at that time another epidemic started with some other mood-altering substances, and I got hooked up into that, and then I ended up meeting, you know, my wife at that time, and just my alcoholism just went to a whole nother level at that point. So much so that I got so out there that I became homeless. And when I say homeless, when they talk about in the big book a low bottom drunk, that was me. When you hear about people living under the bridge, that was me. I was basically out there living on the subways, on the subway station, because sometimes I'd make it to a shelter, but they had, you know, curfews. They had, you know, you had to be in there a certain time. And if you didn't get there, you couldn't get a bed. And so then I'd just have to fend for myself out on the streets. And then if you didn't get in to get nothing to eat, then you still had to fend for yourself on the streets. I had to learn how to eat off the land, you know, trash cans, things like that, you know, whatever I saw, whatever was available, you know. Wait for the Dunkin' Donuts to throw the old donuts out, I'd be there, you know. Wait for the McDonald's or the Pizza Huts to throw out their old food, I'd be there. Need something to drink because I'm dehydrated, look for a running fire hydrant, whatever it took. I slept on park benches, I slept behind dumpsters, I was truly homeless. I eventually started doing some street vending and worked for some guys that, you know, would pay me. A lot of times it was immigrants that were taking over this vending industry, the selling of T-shirts and sweatshirts on the street and watches. So I could be working for Africans, Arabs, Koreans. And what it was is that because I was a veteran, I was able to get the license extremely quick. They would have to wait about 5 years, so they hired you to use your license. And, you know, and they would pay you 20% of what you earned on the street. That was pretty good. You know, I earned about $200 a day. I was able to stay drunk and high daily. And that's what they gave me every day. And I remember it getting so bad that eventually, I mean, even the guys I was working for, as much as they wanted my money, they would often see me after work, you know, and they'd see me out there and like, you know, we just gave this guy $200. What's happened here? You know? And eventually, I chose to seek some help. And I had heard about this VA hospital in Northport, Long Island. And so I said, I'm going to go out here. I'm a veteran. I can get this free help. They talk real good about the treatment program. Went there. You know, they said, well, you know, you got to be clean, you know, at least for 24 or 48 hours. And I tried all those little remedies we often hear about, Golden Seal, vinegar, do this, do that. You know, and I thought I had, you know, did a pretty good deal, showed up. They took me in. By the time we got the group, they let me know, your system was full of stuff, but we're letting you in anyway. And the deal was we'd have group, and what was supposed to happen in group, you were supposed to tell your story so much about how you, you know, what brought you into wanting to come in the program, what you were doing. So I told them my story of I was a vendor. These people paid me $200 a day. I sometimes, because that was 20% of whatever I would collect. And they had begun to trust me, so I might have $1,000 in my hand. And then at the end of the day, they come pick me up, and I give them $1,000. They give me my $200, and I go have a good time till the next morning. And they give me $5 to eat with. You know, I mean, I could go completely broke, but the first thing they would do is give me $5. So I was like, this is great. This is a good deal. You know, how am I going to blow this? I told this story in the treatment center, and afterwards, the people pulled me to the side and said, look, we're going to have to let you go. And I said, what? What do you mean, let me go? They said, because you really don't have a problem. Because a lot of guys were like, you never stole the money? I'm like, no, why would I steal all the money when they're going to give me another $200 tomorrow? I thought it was logical to me. But they said they had this fear that I was going to really, you know, mess everybody else up. So they let me go, and I just called a guy to come pick me up, and I was back at it. Eventually, as our disease is being progressive like it is, you know, it got worse. So much worse to, I think I was about to get in a fight with one of these Arab guys, and these were kind of the guys that we're probably reading about on the TV, you know, that were in militias and stuff like that. And I did something and was just going off, and this guy did a move and was about to choke me out, you know, and I must have had this look on my face like, do what you gotta do. And his brother asked me, he said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I really want to go home, you know, to North Carolina where my mom was. And the guy took me to the Greenhound bus station, saw me on the bus, and then called to make sure I got there. You know, so I'm very grateful to him. I got back to North Carolina, and I immediately started getting back up with the friends of mine that, you know, the older guys that, you know, I had my drinking career with. It seemed like all my friends worked for the beer companies. You know, we one of those deals where, you know, they'd come home and they'd be on their truck and they'll say, "What are we going to do for drinking?" And the guy said, "I guess it's damaged case time." And he would take a case of beer out the truck and drop it. It's a damaged case because if it was damaged, they get to drink it. And that's what we would do. We'd just damage cases of beer just to drink. And, you know, so we went on with that. And, you know, all my friends would get DUIs. The only one is the reason I never got one. I didn't get my license until I was 27. I was your shotgun guy. You know, so that's what I did. I rode shotgun. Everybody else got DUIs but me. Eventually, I ended up hanging out in bootleg spots, shot houses. And, you know, and that was the deal, you know, just drink and hang out there. And I ended up running into a guy from Atlanta, some big shot guy, you know, and he was throwing money around. And then a friend of mine that he was dating, you know, she was like, "Oh, come on, hang out with Leroy, you know. He's got a condo, he's got money, he's got everything, you know." So we go down there and we hang and we're drinking up his stuff and, you know, partying and all that stuff. And in the midst of talking, he's asking me what I do. And at that time, I was doing some turnkey, you know, like where they take apartments and they fix them back up when people move out. And that's what I was doing. He's like, "You're doing construction work, man? You got this gift of gab." He's like, "Man, I got people in Atlanta that make about $2,000 a week talking like you talk." And I'm like, yeah, right. So in the midst of it, he gives me this offer. "Look, come down to Atlanta. I'm telling you, if you can't do this, I'll send you back." He said, "I'll fly you for free, and I'll send you back." And I actually went ahead, and I showed up at the airport with jeans and, you know, and a T-shirt and some sneakers. And sure enough, the ticket was there. Flew into Atlanta, had someone pick me up, and I came into Atlanta and met at this office. And the office was a boiler room for telemarketing. And what it was is that the people were lying on the phone to people, you know, and that's how they were making money. And I felt I lied pretty good. And so my first week, I made $1,500. That was like, and I never have left Atlanta since. That was in 1989. I've still been here since then. And that's what I did. Definitely not the most moral thing. And so I did that. And then you would think that my homelessness and the things that I went through in New York would have been a bottom. But I wasn't quite there yet, because it took on another level. Because now, although I made more money, I did more damage to myself. And what began to happen is I began to go to jail. You know, trying to hang out in the wrong places, you know, doing the wrong things and getting picked up, you know, for soliciting in, you know, various areas and things like that. And eventually I got put on probation. So the first time I got locked up here, they let me go on my own reconnaissance, okay? The second time I got locked up, you know, and each time it would be like maybe 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. So never did any major time, but eventually that little bit of time became enough for me. But the one time I got, that one time after them releasing me on my own reconnaissance date, put me on probation. And then I used to get on the probation officer's nerve, because I would come dressed like this, you know, with my fine money. But every time she would screen me, I would be dirty. And she would get so angry. "So you come down here with your money and your this and your that and your slick talk." And she was just hot with me. So she had it out for me. And this one particular time, I think I ended up getting locked up again. I used to live right here on North Drill Hills and Broad, because this is my area. Okay, and I decided I took, and I used to go to the liquor store right there in Lowman's Plaza, and I bought this big giant can of Heineken that it sticks out the bag, and so I got that, and I've got something else in my hand I shouldn't have, and I'm walking down the sidewalk in broad daylight during rush hour, and as soon as I walk down the street, there's a police car right there in front of me. So I walked past them, and I said, "Okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to run? Or are you going to see if he turns around?" You know, and I got down there, and I saw he was turning around in the traffic, and it just wasn't in me to run that particular day. That might have been best. And he pulled me over, stopped me, found that I had a, you know, warrant because I was on, you know, I was on probation. So that's an automatic violation. Took me to jail. So this time, when I get locked up, the judge basically telling me, listen, here's the deal. We're going to put you on this house arrest type system. Now I'm thinking it's going to be an ankle deal. So I'm like, I could do that. But what they put me on is this machine that you have to buy yourself, and it's like a phone, and it has a breathalyzer on it. So when they call, the first thing I have to do is give them a voice check. This is Leroy Murphy, right? Then, after I'm doing the voice check, I got to get ready to blow in the breathalyzer and hit a button that takes my picture blowing in the breathalyzer. So every time they call, this is what I got to do. So I'm doing good for a few days. And then I get this neat idea, alcoholic thinking. If I buy some non-alcoholic beer, I could pull this off. Now, what most of us know is that non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics. Also, non-alcoholic beer has 0.5% alcohol in it. Just for you people that are new that might think this is a slick way to go. Okay? And if you were to drink 24 cans of 0.5% alcohol, chances are you're going to blow something. So, pretty much I was done. I already had the feeling like I was drunk. So, I just didn't, you know, I didn't answer it no more. I took off, and, you know, and I think my last little deal was there used to be a book nook right down here on Claremont, and I took all the cassette tapes I had, and I sold them for my last run, and then I had an Everything Must Go sale in my apartment, because my wife at the time, she had gone to New York with my, you know, son, who was pretty much newborn, and I took and I sold everything in the house, everything but the kitchen sink, literally. And then I decided I was going to, you know, I'd go back to my little telemarketing job, get some quick money. Because one of the things about the telemarketing job was, is that it was a big enabler. And one of the things that would happen is that they knew that most of us had, you know, alcohol and drug problems. And so as a motivation, they would be like, well, look, if you come in here and you make me X amount of money today, I'm going to give you $500. And that's what the deal was. It was the closest thing, you know, to being pimped out that, you know, that I could identify with. And because that's what it pretty much was. He knew that he could use me that way. And the money was a motivator, you know. And that's what I did. And so this last run, after I got done, went to the job, made some money, got my fine money up, do my same little pattern, I'm on dress up, and I call the probation officer, seen her for me in 2 weeks, and I was like, hey, it's me. And she's like, where you been? She's like, where you been? I was like, nah, you know, I've been around, you know. She said, did you use? I said, nah, kind of, sort of. And she said, well, come on down, we'll talk about it. You know, now in my mind, alcoholic thinking, I got it. I'm dressed up. I got my money. I'm so slick. I'm going to catch a cab down there, all the way down to 10th Street and Peachtree. And I get down there, and it's a pretty full room, about this full, with, you know, people that are on probation. I've been on a 2-week binge. I'm a little sleepy, so I nod. And I nod off for an hour or two, and I wake up, it's a little thinner. I nod off, and then I see my probation officer walk in. She's like, oh, hi, Leroy, I'll be with you in a minute. I nod back on. Well, after a couple of more nods, I'm the only one in the building. And so I was like, okay, you know, I'm the last one. And I nod back off, and the next thing I know, I feel somebody coming toward me, and it's two people. And it's one guy with some handcuffs, and he said, Leroy Murphy, got a warrant for your arrest. And then all I remember her telling me is, Leroy, I told you not to use. I mean, in the car, they get me in the police car, and she is saying this all the way to Rice Street, Fulton County Jail. I was like, but please, please, my family needs me. I'm the only provider. That was my line. I'm the sole provider. They need me. She said, nope, told you not to use, nope, and she took me to jail. This last time, again, feeling like, you know, I was, you know, one of these prostitutes, phone prostitutes, the guy that I work for, he finds out I'm in jail, I'm his earner. He's like, well, look, I'm going to get you a good lawyer, we're going to get you out. And this lawyer, he sends me, says, look, okay, here's the deal. We got to make them think you are the worst alcoholic there is. So there's this test you got to take. And they give me this little thick booklet, and you're going to answer all these questions. And he says, it's probably going to take you about 3 or 4 hours, but just answer them like, you know, you are the worst, right? I mean, the thing took me like 2 hours, hour and a half, and I didn't have any problem checking what I needed to check, just honestly. You know? And we go in front of the judge. The judge says, nah, you know, this guy, I want him in some kind of facility or something. And it's like, you know, well, I just want him to go to Mar straight from jail. But there was a six-month waiting list for Mar. And I'm like, I can't be in here for those 6 months. The most I'd ever spent was maybe a month in there. I'm like, I can't do this, because one of the things that happened while I was locked up, and this was my moment of clarity, was I was in the jail with these people, and I would listen to the guys talk about, man, I know how I got in here. If I hadn't have been messing with that female, or if I hadn't have been hanging with so-and-so, I wouldn't have got locked up. So when I go back out there this time, this is what I'm going to do. I said, they're locked up in here now, and they're saying they're going to go back out and try to do what they were doing again. I said, that's crazy. And I said, I'm in here with them, and I'm crazy. And, it, you know, I really did want to be there. I mean, jail was a big motivator for me. And I did the foxhole prayer like I've done many other times. Get me out of this one. I promise I won't do it no more. Went in front of the judge. And he was telling me that I was going to have to go to Mar and stay for 6 months. And then I told the attorney when they were taking me back to the holding cell, I said, I need to talk to him again. I said, I can't do this. I said, can I talk to him directly? He said, it doesn't matter. Can you get me in front of him? And he got me back in front of him, and I said, you know, please, my basic line, I'm the sole provider, my family needs me, da-da-da-da-da. And by the grace of God, he said, you know what? He said, I'm going to give you a week. Come up with another program that I'm comfortable with, and I'll give it a shot. And the same program we came to him that day, we came back to him with the exact same program, and he said, okay. So I was supposed to leave straight from the jail, go to the treatment program. So they let me out on a Friday, got out, made it to the convenience store, didn't drink, just got a pack of cigarettes, got on Martyr, and then when I got off at Lindbergh, I had this idea. You know, there were my wife had some cousins here that we drank with and partied with. And I said, you know, I should drive by there and let them know that I'm okay. So we drove by in the cab. I said, I'm not going to get out. So we drove by in the cab in front of their apartment window, and I said, hey, it's me. I'm out. You know, and they said, oh, hey. I was like, well, I got to go now. So I go home. Now the obsession begins. The obsession starts. And I go on home, and I get home, and I'm there by myself. And I'm like, the next thing I know, I call them. Come get me. And it begins, and the binge begins. And even in New York, all the way to here, whenever I would have my binges, it is nothing worse than that, you know, next day of guilt, shame, and remorse. Oh! So many times I wanted to jump off the jump off the platform in New York in front of the train, but I never had the guts to do it, you know? I'd be walking around, and I'd just be, God, I did it again, like the book says. And, finally I showed up that Monday, and they asked where I'd been, and I said, I was locked up for a while, you know, I hadn't been with a woman, whatever lie I gave them. And so they went on with group, and then I began to feel this guilt of not telling them the truth. So toward the end of the group, I was like, I got a confession I use, and it was like, we know, and, you know. Because one of the guys, he was sitting there saying, okay, he said, so you were locked up for about a month, month and a half. And he said, then you got out, and you didn't use. I said, no. He said, I would have, you know. And, anyway, when they said that, then the director said, well, you know, the judge told me if Leroy screwed up, that I could bring him back. When I heard him say the words, it petrified me. That petrified me, the thought of going back. And I'm like, well, these people are one of me. Surely they wouldn't say send him to jail. And the first guy was like, F him. If he ain't serious about his recovery, send his ass back. And then I was like, it just a lump just fell down on my chest, you know, because I just didn't want to go back. And there was this other guy that I became good friends with that was one of the house managers. And he said, well, I think if he's serious about it this time, we should at least try to give him a shot. And they did. And me and him became very close friends. There would be six people in the halfway house, and our deal would be, because it was outpatient for me, So now, mind you, I'm still doing telemarketing. You know, look, they told me not to make no major decisions in the first year. I took it to heart, you know, and that's what I, so I continued doing that, but there's more to that. And so I would get off work, and I would get on the bus, and I would catch the bus from Lawrenceville Highway in North Jude Hills. My treatment center was on Claremont, over by the train station, over there on Chamblee Tucker. And I would catch the bus over there. And then we would have our 3 hours of group, class, and a meeting. Then we would all leave there together and go to the halfway house. And the thing that happened for me is that me and this other guy that said, hey, we should give him a shot, we would get our food and we would sit in the living room and we would talk and eat. And we would talk about recovery and trying to live life on life's terms and trying to do this recovery process. The other guys did something totally different. By the time that 6 months was up, me and him were the only ones left in that halfway house. And I think that is a direct result of one alcoholic sharing with another. You know, that's what we did every night. And then I started going to, they made us go to mandatory meetings. I started going to the Triangle Men's meeting, that morning meeting. And that's when I heard a man share, like they say in the big book, with some depth and weight, where I was able to identify, because at first I thought you were a bunch of squares. I was like, none of these people drink or did the kind of things I did. I'm doing my 9 months probation. I'm going to stack a little money. I'm going to gain a little weight, and I'm out. But then I heard a guy share, and he shared how he used to drink like I had been drinking, and that he had some peace, and his life was so much better. And that sounds so attractive to me, especially the peace. And then I, you know, then I heard them say, well, if you don't have a sponsor, get you a temporary sponsor. And I got one. And when I got the temporary sponsor, I said, well, you know, how soon do I work the steps? I've been hearing about these steps. He said, how soon are you going to get well? We immediately got to the steps. And I worked up to step four with him. I think the thing about step four, if any of you that have worked it or might be working it, is that it's real easy to procrastinate. Now, it took me 9 months to do mine. I don't suggest that you do that, okay? But that's just how I would procrastinate. I would start on it a little bit, it stirs some stuff up in me, and then I put it down. And what he always told me, he said, always stay close to a meeting so that when it does that, you can go to a meeting. But you got to keep going with it. And eventually that's what I, you know, I had to do. I mean, in fact, me and one guy, we had to end up making a pact together to go to the library one night, and that we were going to work on our four steps. And we went to the library downtown that stayed open late, and we worked on the four step until we finished it. Because at that point, I didn't want to drink no more. I didn't want to go back to jail. Drinking for me meant jail. They told me about playing the tape all the way through, and, you know, as many times as the drink would sound good, by the time I took the drink and I went through the normal progression of what would happen, I always ended up in jail. So once I got there, it was like, I can't do that. And so then I started taking some suggestions about putting some things in between the first drink, between the thought and the first drink. First of all, that a thought was just a thought. I didn't have to act on it. And so he's like, try putting, calling somebody, try putting, going to a meeting, try praying, try reading some literature. And by the time you try to do all this stuff in between that next drink, usually you probably won't want it for a while. Because it was a tough deal going to Triangle regularly, and the Tower Liquor Store was right there, you know. Because, you know, that was a big deal, and I would have to talk my way, because I'm catching the bus, so I'd have to talk my way past the Tower Liquor Store and run that tape through. Then what started happening is I heard people talk about the meeting before the meeting, meeting after the meeting, and one day I would start hanging out after the meetings. And I really didn't feel I had much in common, because when I was going to Triangle, I might have been one of three black guys that was showing up at that time. So it was a little tough for me culturally, you know, but I knew that you had something that I wanted. I didn't want to drink no more, and you people had something. So, you know, I forced myself not to quit 5 minutes before the miracle happened, like I heard them say. And one day we were hanging out after the meeting, and they was like, well, we're going to eat sushi. I know nothing about sushi. Never had it, right? But I said, look, all I know is when I'm hanging out with these people, I don't drink, I don't get high. So I'm going to have sushi. I loved it. Still love it to this day. Had the greatest time ever. The next thing I know, they talked about having sober softball. Sober softball. Never knew anything about that. Anytime I'd ever been out on a softball field, there was a beer between my legs, you know. Standing in the outfield. Let me know when it comes, you know. But I did this deal, and it was the greatest thing ever, you know. Sober softball, we had a ball, and it was these kind of things that kind of started engaging me. And I'm continuing to work the steps, and I had to go to the Clarkston group on Sundays. And by the time I got to my fifth step, there was another guy that I wanted to do my fifth step with. And when I did my fifth step with him, I wanted him to kind of take me a little bit further in the steps. And, you know, the fear of the fifth step, you know, when I share this with this guy, you know, he is going to, you know, take off running. You know, and I shared, you know, my best deal. Bam, here you go. And he was like, bam, here you go back. You know, and I was like, well, that's no big deal, you know. And that took a lot of weight off me on that fifth step. And then I had this guy that I was in the telemarketing business with. And we came in together drinking and getting high and partying. And he would say, man, you got to come over to this other group, man, this heavy hitters, man. And they go to this, you know, Rock Eagle thing, man. You got to come, da-da-da-da-da. And he kept bothering me. And I'm like, look, because about this time I got about, you know, I got about a couple of years, okay? And I'm like, look, this thing is working for me, man. Why are you trying to get me to stop my rhythm? This is working. I don't want to change nothing. I don't want to do nothing. The play is working. I'm going to keep going with it, right? And I share with this guy on the porch. In the meeting one day, I said, you know, this guy keeps trying to get me to go to this other meeting and all of this, you know, and, you know, I'm trying to get a little pissed. And he's like, well, you might have to. Now I'm getting pissed with him. Like, what do you mean I might have to? And what he shared with me, he said, well, Leroy, there may be some people over there that may be able to relate to you a lot more than some people here. And they probably need to hear what you have to say. I said, all right. So I started going over to the heavy hitters. Immediately connected, went to Rock Eagle, immediately connected to that. I mean, just like the big book says when it talks about the different inventories when you go into step 10, about how we occasionally take retreats, the stuff works. You know, to just go out for a weekend, you know, no distractions, you know, no women, no work, you know, so I don't have to sit and do this, you know, profound sharing to get you to like me and all of that stuff. I'm able to just kick it with some guys and just talk about recovery and work on some stuff. And it worked for me, you know, to do that every 3 to 6 months. And I continued on. I mean, of course, I, you know, worked 6 and 7. Now, I got to tell you, with 6, skip some stuff. Skip some stuff, you know, because it tells you shouldn't have any reservations, all that neat stuff, right? And when I did step 4, I had no problems doing step 4 with the resentments and writing all the stuff and my part in it. But when it came to the sexual behavior, I kind of skipped that one. And then when step 6 wanted to talk about the glaring defect, which had to do with my lust, I skipped that one. I was not ready to give that up. I thought it would have a direct effect on my libido, so I wasn't trying to give that up. So we just kept moving on with the rest of the steps. But what it says in the big book is it lets you know that, you know, it tells you, you know, you can take some of the glaring ones and put them on the back burner, but there'll be trouble if you do. And it was that was the very one, probably 14 years later, that ate my lunch. And I had to go back. And I had to go ahead and dig all the way back. And to be able to dig all the way back and realize where my sexual behavior got twisted. You know, when I saw some friends of my mother and father's that slept over having sex in my room. And that did something to me. But I never would look at it. Because from that point on, sex meant a whole other thing to me, and I did a whole lot of stuff, and I hurt a whole lot of women, and I hurt myself, and a whole lot of things that caused me a lot of problems. And I had to go back and work 4, 5, and 6 on that again, and 7, and work on that again. The amends process, you know, learned real, you know, early to take the step literally, except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, I had to learn that, you know, we make them whenever, wherever possible. Well, even though I had robbed from a lot of people in telemarketing, was I going to go to the FBI and say, look, you guys are probably looking for me because I did all this stuff? No. But did I not try to do that stuff no more? Absolutely. Did I try to help some other people? Absolutely. You know, so sometimes you have to be very careful and not read too much more into this stuff than what it's saying. Of course, you know, 10 began to help me a lot to start daily taking a look at myself. You know, looking over my day, who did I harm? Who did I hurt? What could I have said better? What could I have done better? You know, doing some journaling. A lot of this kind of stuff helped me along the way. In the process, I create this foundation from working the steps. And when I first came in, as far as with the higher power deal, I was raised in the church early on. That's all we did. And I made a vow, you know, when I was probably in ninth grade that, you know, as soon as I get old enough not to go to church, I'm not ever going again. And I didn't. I didn't go again until I came back in this program. You know, and it was because when I came in and you all told me, at first, I understood you were telling me about having the higher power of my understanding, but the only thing I could get out of it was using you all at that time, because I didn't really use God effectively, even though I thought I knew him, but I really didn't, but I thought I did. And I didn't know how I had to use him effectively. So I had to use you guys. You guys weren't drinking. You guys were telling me one day at a time you had this years and times away from the drink and your lives had gotten better. So you guys were high power. Now, as I worked the steps, that changed for me. That changed. One thing about this program, if you do this program exactly the way it out, I guarantee you, you can't help but change. You know, when I was first doing the, probably in my first year, I was still doing the telemarketing, like I told you. And what I found out real quick was everybody, now that I'm not drinking, I'm seeing that everybody is still drinking and partying, and they're certainly not going to stop because I'm stopped. And I would read my big book at my desk, and I would pray. And one day this guy walks in, and he sits directly behind me. And he sees me reading the big book, and he says, "So you're a friend of Bill's." I don't know this deal yet, right? I'm like, "Friend of who?" He says, "Friend of Bill's." "Oh, the big book. Got it. I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "I got about 6 months or so." And he said, "I got about 7 years." And so him and I began to talk while I was having to go through that telemarketing deal. And as I began to work the steps, it became very uncomfortable to do something that was immoral, because the principles of the steps won't let you do it. You can't occupy, it can't occupy the same space. You can't be practicing a principle and then practice a defect and it really work. It won't fit. Promise you. Won't fit. You'll do one or you'll do the other. And I knew that the only way I was going to feel comfortable and continue doing that telemarketing was I was going to have to drink and party like they did. And so then I had gotten to that year and I was able to walk away from that job and do something different and trust God that he would provide me with a way to provide for my family. By this time, I've gotten a daughter that's come into play. My ex-wife was my using buddy. That was tough. So, again, I try not to make any major decisions that first year, like, because I thought I just needed to divorce her, and that was the deal. I ended up staying with her while I was still in recovery for 4 years, because I would share about how bad this was. And also in my sharing, I shared real crazy. I mean, Rusty's known me from day one. I came in cussing and fussing and sounding real homicidal, and you guys showed me so much patience. And it was people like Rusty and a guy named Joe Lewis who pulled me out of a co-ed meeting one day and said, "Come here, young man. You don't have to use that filthy language. Those ladies don't have to listen to what you got to say. They don't have to hear that stuff." For whatever reason, maybe because he was like 6'6", I probably listened to him. And I began to practice not cursing. And that's happened for many years now, that I make it a point not to use profanity. That's just my choice. I'm not saying that's what you got to do. That's just what I chose to do. And it was things like that began to happen, you know. And then God just started providing for me. And then I met a guy when I was constantly fussing about my wife's problem, and he shared with me. He was like, "Listen, your wife's stuff is your wife's stuff. He said, but I can tell you this. He said, I've been in your position, and he said, I had to pray for my wife that she would find recovery. He said, now, it took 4 years for me. I can't tell you how long it's going to take for you. But I took a suggestion. I prayed for her every day. And within about a year or two, she chose to want to come into treatment. I still probably enabled her a little bit because I had money and I paid for her treatment. And it didn't stick, of course. But, you know, at least I went through that process. And I ended up having to get custody of my kids. And that was a big deal. But the judge gave me custody of my 2-year-old daughter, my 6-year-old son. So now I'm a single parent in recovery with about 4 or 5 years. And I'm going to my sponsor like, I'm not prepared for this. Why me? And he's like, why not you? You know, he said, if nothing else, just to help the next guy who may go through this. So that's what I did. And I brought my kids, me and my son, he's 19 now. We were just talking today, and it came up about the meetings. He said, Dad used to take us to those meetings. We knew all the stuff because I would take them to church. And when we would say the Lord's Prayer, after the Lord's Prayer, they said, keep coming back because it works if you work. And me and him laughed about that today. He said, you know, you took us to meetings all the time. And that was the deal. I took my kids to meetings all the time. I had to do what I had to do because I had to get this. It was that important. You know, later on, I continue to stay in the program and give service and, you know, participate in my home group. And then some tragedies begin to happen because life doesn't stop because we stop drinking. It just doesn't. And I ended up getting kidney disease. And it had gotten so bad that I was pretty much at total kidney failure. And I had to go on dialysis. And I did dialysis for 3.5 years. The blessing was I didn't have to go to a place and have it done. They had gotten so advanced that I could do dialysis myself from home. And, these, you know, whenever you did them, you had to really be very clean and follow direction, which you guys had taught me to do. And so they told me what I needed to do, and I did it to the letter, and I would not change nothing. And by the grace of God, for 3.5 years of dialysis, I never had one complication. Nothing. Everything went fine. And then I got to a level of acceptance with doing the dialysis because they were saying, oh, a transplant could take this long, take that long. And one day I remember walking outside my job and saying, you know, God, you're allowing me to have a quality of life where I can still take care of my children. And if I've got to do dialysis for the rest of my life till you take me, so be it. And it lifted a ton of weight off of me, you know, and I was able to continue living life. So I went on with that, and then a few years later, some more tragedy hit. I left my daughter with her grandmother, and some of the rest of my cousins, we left the grandmothers wanted to hang out with their granddaughters, and they were going to travel from Wilmington, North Carolina to Charlotte, North Carolina, and they were driving in an SUV that they had rented, and between there and getting to Charlotte, an 18-wheeler ran them off the road. And it killed my daughter, and she was 9 at the time, and it killed another cousin of mine who was also 9, and one of my aunts. And my mother survived, another aunt of mine survived, and a niece and a cousin survived. There was 6 of them in the car. And what I can remember that day is that I was in the mortgage business at this time, and when I had gotten the call that there had been an accident, the possible, you know, there were some fatalities, and of course the hospital isn't going to tell you who or what at that time. But when I got off the phone, as a direct result of practicing this program and creating a foundation, when the promises talk about intuitively knowing how to handle situations, what used to baffle us, the very first thing I did was call one of the guys in the program and say, I need you now. Then I sit in the car and I pray. And, you know, I shared this with my son for the first time today. When I prayed that day, I said, Lord, please save my daughter. I said, if you save my daughter, I said, if you want me to preach all over this world for you, I'll do it. Okay, and that was real significant later. In any event, you know, 2 of my friends in the program showed up on the spot. At the exact moment they showed up in my bedroom, I got the call that my daughter was one of the deceased. They let me cry and they let me have it. And then I got up, and the very next thing, intuitively knowing how to handle situations used to handle it. You mean, intuitively knowing how to handle situations used to baffle us. The first thing I say is, all right. 2 things I need. I said, I need a meeting and I need a cigarette. I had stopped smoking for some years. And then my friend looks at me, he's like, okay, as long as that's all you're going to do, you know. He was just very cautious, you know. And he stuck by my side, and before the night was over, this is why it's so important to get a home group. You know, if you're new, get a home group. Let some people know you. You know, don't sit like a fly on the wall. You know, if you don't let anybody know you, how are they going to ever know if you need help? Okay? And the first thing that happened is that I got all these people in my house from my home group. It's full. And they stayed with me the entire night. And, you know, and they loved me, and they cared for me, and they held me up. And I don't know what I would have done without this program. As much as I love my family members, they could not have given me what you all gave me. Because you all knew me. You all knew the things I was capable of in a situation like that and how serious and important that is. You know, earth people and our family members don't always know that. You know, for a long time, my mother would be, you still got to go to those meetings? And I would have to hit her with, well, Mom, remember when I used to do this and I call you for money and I may have took this and I may have taken that? I said, it'll happen again if I don't. She said, well, you keep going to those meetings, honey. You know? And, you know, what ended up happening is that I got through that. It's like right after that, I was able to go to Rock Eagle, and people started having me do service work, and it just gradually it eased the pain a little, and I had to learn how to, you know, do patience and tolerance, love and tolerance would be in our code, because a lot of people would say, oh, your daughter's in a better place, and let me be honest with you, I didn't want to hear that crap. But then somebody shared with me and said, Leroy, they're trying to love on you the best way they know how, and they're doing the best that they can do. And I had to let them. I had to let them love on me the only way they knew how, and understand they were doing the best that they could. And I got through that. And getting through that, God reminded me of the commitment that I made to Him. He reminded me, I, because of this program, I started getting closer and closer to the church of my youth. And in doing that, you know, I was reading the big book, and I started reading what my sponsor would call the big, big book. And then they started working together. They're two different things. I don't confuse it. And I don't try to mix them. They're two different things, but they work together. And he just kept calling on my life that, you know, he wanted me to be in the ministry, you know, at the service of my church. So about a year and a half ago, I accepted my call to the ministry. And that's what I've been doing, and that's been different, you know, because for a moment I thought the church people would act like y'all, you know, and I realized they're not gonna act like y'all. I can't sit there and say, you know what I thought about doing today, you know. So we don't do that. But what has happened is so much that this program has given me. Oh man, so much. You know, that whole liberty of, you know, not trying to shove something down your throat, you know. You know, I still have to practice the same thing with them. I'm like, this is what I got to give you, you know. And sometimes, just like we wait for in here when newcomers come, and maybe they want it, maybe they don't. Maybe we have to let them go back out. Same deal. Sometimes they want it, sometimes they don't. I'm here if you need me. But it's been doing wonders for my life. Being able to give service to this program and to give service to God and people outside this program, it has been such a blessing. You know, my life, you know, I'm right now, I'm fighting to pay bills just like everybody else, you know. And a lot of days, the money just ain't there. And I look at it and I'm looking at what's owed and what needs to be paid. It ain't there. And I have to pray. You know, and it says in the big book, faith without works is dead, you know. You know, I could sit here and say I have faith all day long, but if I'm not doing nothing, nothing's going to happen. Nothing changes, you know. And that's what you people have given me. You've given me a new way to live without alcohol, you know. And now, as selfish and self-centered as I am, I think more about you than I do about myself. But I used to think it's about self-preservation. I'm going to help you when I can help you. That's not what the book says. That's not what the book says. Check this out. I'm not even clean and not drinking for me. That was never the intended purpose. The intended purpose was for me to get clean so I could help somebody else. Me getting clean was just a byproduct. That's the only way this works. The moment, you know, it says the guiding principle has to be giving rather than getting. That's what it says in the book. You know, and it's served well for me. I'm going to say this and close because I know I'm at my time now, or even past. But one of the things that that has been extremely important, you know, in this process is being able to sponsor someone else and take them through the steps. Because, you know, I'll be quick since I have a few 24 hours to think that I'm okay. But it's nothing like getting a newcomer or a sponsee or someone in your network who calls you and says, this is what I got going on, to give you a swift reminder that a drink is no further than my elbow to my mouth at any given moment. The other thing is that I told you all about the sex thing and going back, and when I went back, I ended up getting a lot of pain between hurting people in that process, hurting women. And I couldn't do it anymore. Just like with the drinking, it got to a point where it was no longer fun. It was no longer working. So what I was doing was no longer fun. So I ended up praying one day. If you don't want God to answer you, you better not pray. And I said, look, I'm tired of this. I can't do it no more. Take the lust. I don't want it. I don't care what you do with it. If you tell me to be abstinent for 5 years, I'll do it. And within a matter of months, I ended up seeing somebody in my church who had been there for the whole 10 years I'd been there, but I never paid her any attention. But this day, I paid her attention in a play where she played a slave in slave clothing because it was Black History Month. And I just looked at her and said, And then I started walking by her pew, and then I started meeting her in the parking lot, talking to her on the internet, phone, met her in a coffee shop, and we've been engaged for the past 2 years, and we've been together for the past three, and I've still had to remain abstinent. And, you know, it used to be tough, but it's getting better. It's getting better. But these are the blessings. These are what's important to me. The fact that my son is in college, and he's doing okay. You know, the fact that, you know, me and my dad's relationship, I made an amends to him, and we're the best of friends, and he's sick with cancer right now. Now, he had to take him to the emergency room last night because he had stomach cancer and he had some surgery. But I'm able to be present. I'm able to be there, and he's able to feel that, you know, and that's a great feeling to be present because I wasn't always present. This is just a blast. This program is the best thing since sliced bread. You know, whatever you got to do, you got to be at a place where you're willing to do whatever it takes to get this. It's got to be that important to you. I can't live without it. And I appreciate you all allowing me to share with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Leroy. We needed that, for sure. Frank, would you give out the chips, please? I'm Frank Waters, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And this is my pacifier, my serenity stick. Here at the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting, they have a chip system, like they do in every other meeting in NAVA. Have a white chip for the people who want to try this way of life one day at a time, 1 minute at a time. Or if you're coming back and want to start over, you have a white chip. After 30 days, you have the silver chip. It's not silver, it's aluminum. Don't try to pawn it anywhere. There are drunks that have tried to do that, yeah. After 90 days, you get a red chip. After 6 months, it's a yellow chip. 9 months, a green chip. In years, in multiple years, a blue chip. Does anyone here tonight need a white chip? Okay. Is it a bomb or okay? Anybody? Does anybody have 30 days? Damn. Okay. Does anybody else need a silver chip? Anybody have 90 days? Anybody have 6 months? Okay, we're done. Okay. Does anybody have 9 months? Okay.
Anybody else have 9 months? Are there any birthdays, years, or multiples of years? And for those of y'all that have missed how Leroy did that, it'll be on NavoClub.org later on, I'm sure. So just check it out. Congratulations on Gypsy Hole.
Congratulations to all of those chip earners. And Leroy, yes, I meant to mention that. September 23rd? 27th. Yeah, so last week, 18 years. Good work. Now it's time for AA-related announcements or NAVA Club announcements. I know we need to make it pretty quick, but go ahead.
Rocky Eagle still has openings available for the October 14th, 15th, and 16th. That's the 60th Rock, and there's a registration form out in the lobby, or you can go on thelandmansworkshop.org. Got a registration form there to see me or Terry Pennington about getting a scholarship, and it'll change your life. I swear it will.
And sure, I'll never call. And sure, on that same thing for the Netherlands Workshop, we have a golf tournament Friday morning prior to the Rock. If anybody would like to play in that tournament or sign up for it, see me after me.
Just tell an alcoholic. I do.
Okay, and we've got some things coming up this month here at the NAVA Club. On the 22nd, we're going to do another coffee shop downstairs with live entertainment with various artists. And it was a great time last time. Advance tickets are available at $5. And then on the 23rd, there's going to be a yard sale. And if you have anything you'd like to contribute, and it's too large for you to get it here, they do have a crew running a truck to come to your home and get rid of anything, pick up anything that you'd like to get rid of. And then on the 29th, we're having a Halloween dance that's going to be benefiting the Freedom Group of Cobb County. And so there's costume contest and everything you expect, plus a real DJ. And we are looking to have a big month in entertainment here at NAVA. Sorry to keep you here so late, but if there's a couple of you that could help us break down the coffee machine, thank you. Thank you. All right, fantastic. Well, if there are no further announcements, I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join hands.
Sober. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. He come back for the work to be worked.
Thing
hang out in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I'm lonesome day and night. I need someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I got to go. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.